a statement.
I think Chrissy's also joining us. We'll just be but I think we have some slides and you've got some of the practice statements as well.
Those were distributed.
They were distributed. So we're on agenda number 5. And the practice statement was distributed earlier. If anyone needs a copy, raise your hand and I'll give you one.
Okay.
Should we begin? Should we let Chrissy?
I think we can.
Oh, she was just outside printing it off.
Yeah.
So I think she's on her way.
We can start, do we? Or do we want to? Yeah, we can start.
Okay, cool. So the purpose of this session is to find if you find the draft practice statement helpful in understanding the decisions that preparers have made in producing financial statements. So I won't go through the slide deck in detail because you've been sent it. So just briefly introduce the. So we'll just briefly introduce the practice statement and then get down to the questions because that's how we're all here. So I think if we start on slide 4 perhaps, I think it's important to contextualise the practice statement within the disclosure initiative. So the materiality practice statement is one of our implementation projects at the moment. The disclosure initiative is obviously aimed at improving disclosures and financial statements. So there's two parts of the disclosure initiative which deal with materiality. The materiality practice statement, which this is, and the principles of disclosure discussion paper, which will be published at the end of Q1 next year. And that discusses whether we should look at changing the definition of materiality. So I think it's important to know that at the moment we're not changing the definition of materiality. The practice statement is just a practice statement on how to apply materiality, and we're not changing it. So we expect that if we do change it following the PAR discussion paper, that everything that we've written will be in line, but if we don't, then we'll update it. So we're undertaking a project on materiality because we've heard that there's people experience difficulty in understanding the concept, and we want to improve and clarify how we see the application of materiality. So we're producing the guidance in particular to focus on two problems that we've heard during outreach. So we've continuously heard from users and preparers that something needs to be done about the application of materiality. In particular, we've heard that there's a tendency to focus too much on quantitative aspects of materiality, and there's a lack of clarity about how the materiality judgment happens. So we wanted to issue guidance to try and alleviate those problems. So a practice statement is a non-mandatory form of guidance. There's currently one on management commentary, and this will be the second one. So this is the second practice statement that the ISB would issue if we issue it. So it's non-authoritative guidance, but that doesn't impact the fact that there is a requirement in IS1 and ISH to apply materiality. So entities aren't required to comply with it unless a jurisdiction can mandate it, so that would be up to the individual jurisdictions. So the objective of the practice statement is to assist management in applying the concept of materiality, and we'd also hope that it would help users to understand how, and regulators understand how, preparers have come to the decisions that they've come to, so help everyone understand how we've got it. So I won't go through, slide 9 is just what's in the practice statement that you've been sent on. So if we move on to slide 10, and the interaction between the practice statement and national guidance. So it is true that some jurisdictions have their own guidance on the application of materiality, and we did quite a lot of research and outreach on this at the beginning. And we don't expect that there will be a conflict between the practice statement and the national guidance. So the practice statement is aimed at management and preparers rather than users or help users. And this is mainly because the problems that we've heard associated with the application of materiality are mainly focused on the preparers, and we hope that the practice statement will improve the quality of disclosures and therefore have a positive impact on those who are using the financial statements. So if we move on to the questions, perhaps if I go through all of the questions and then we have a general discussion?
No, let's do the question by question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That just hasn't worked for us.
Question by question has been having different reactions. So the first question is, do you think this practice statement helps investors to understand the materiality judgments that management have gone through in the process of preparing the financial statements?
Can I ask a question beforehand? Because I went through the practice statement and I just wondered how much of the practice statement was already somewhere in the standards itself. Because it to me it felt like, okay, I recognize this, I recognize that. how much is new?
Well, in a sense, we haven't. This isn't a standard, so we're not introducing new requirements. Instead, we're kind of describing the requirement that's already there and bringing it all together to make it useful, so it's there in one document and preparers can have it as a facilitator for discussions. So rather than it being scattered throughout the standards, bringing it together.
So I think a lot of it is parts that were already in our literature brought into one place, as you say, but in some of the areas, such as descriptions about how you might think about things, such as who the primary users are, and some more of the discussion on things like quantitative versus qualitative, some of those areas you sort of hummed a few more bars in terms of what those ideas might mean when you actually come to make decisions.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You've built on ideas that were already there.
Yeah, and I think if you look through the practice statement, we're pretty clear where we've picked up from other standards or other places, and particularly the conceptual framework, and that then we go to describe how those might be applied. And I'm quite impressed that you recognise some of these, because I know as a preparer, I actually didn't go to the conceptual framework that often, so, and some of the other standards. So it's interesting to have it all in one place is actually very helpful in and of itself.
I think it's helpful as well, but I can imagine it's actually because if there were duplication, it actually makes it maybe more difficult to make it a standard, and because then you get, okay, where should I refer that to, because it's now two places defined maybe. Did I notice correctly that it was quite a bit of a close call whether it should become a standard or not, or was it hands down, this should not become a standard, this should be a practice statement? In the board?
I think at the board there was some kind of discussion about whether there was almost three options. There was make it a standard, make it, or four, make a practice statement, make it implementation guidance, or make it educational material. And we did have a discussion at the board, but I think at the end people were quite happy to have it as a practice statement, or at least to have the exposure draft as a practice statement and see what reaction we got to that.
I didn't hear a lot of requests that this should be authoritative guidance, so it shouldn't be a standard. So I would have thought that view, even though it's expressed, was a minority view. I think most board members, from my recollection, was that they were happy that this was not authoritative, and actually more of the discussion was whether it should be a practice statement or perhaps implementation guidance to a standard.
It's not really written in a style that may be suitable to be a standard, I think, because there are lots of examples and it just doesn't look like a standard. I think if you wanted to put it into a standard, it would need to be completely rewritten properly.
More of a discussion to me, back and forth.
Yeah. One of the reasons for having it as a practice statement or something that was non-authoritative is to that point, so that we could really explore and explain a particular issue. If we're in a standard, we need to be very, set the requirements, if you like, and I think it would be a very different document.
What's your feet?
Scotland, apologies, I don't think I'm going to answer question, but I did want to say a couple of things before we get to the questions. One was, I think when this was brought to us previously, I can't remember when, the question that I raised is, if we all accept that there's a problem with materiality, I don't have an issue with that. What I had an issue with or concern is it a question of enforcement rather than lack of guidance from the IFRS? And I was very much, it's the former, and I don't think this was a good use of the ISB's time, but we are where we are. And the question and the debate that we're having now is this non-authoritative guidance or is it a standard? And Peter, I appreciate you said it's not written as a standard, but that could reflect the fact that it wasn't thought about, or you know, let's not do it as an enforceable core part of IFRS. And I think that's unhelpful because one of the things that that you said is that some of us recognise the language. You said actually I didn't, and I used to be prepared. You didn't look at anything except IFRS, and this is not going to be IFRS. So are they going to look at it? I'm not sure. So I'm still rather sceptical about the value of this. But having said that, this might be slightly schizophrenic. Is that if you are going to go into it, then at least let's think about how to make it more effective and more used. And I think that might require it to be. I appreciate it's not standard, it's traditional, but some way to say when the preparer makes a statement, these financial statements are in compliance with IFRS, that includes this requirements and this thing.
The requirement to disclose material information is a requirement in IFRS. And therefore, that requires some judgments and decisions. So I think, in some way, you can. That is almost the decision point that needs to be adhered to, and I think that's already the case in IFRS.
Yeah, but as you said, it's kind of a lot of this stuff is already in parts of the IFRS body of literature. If not in the IFRS, then it's not, in your view, it's not being applied. For me, that's an enforcement issue, not an application issue. But if you feel it's an application issue, then having another non-authoritative piece of literature doesn't really address the application issue, perhaps.
This is a very difficult item for enforcers.
Yeah.
Really difficult. So I think the enforcers are very glad if they can have some kind of help in this respect.
Yeah. But do they need... I'd like to think, question what aspects more than what we currently have in IFRS that you would think we would need to include. So materiality is a judgment or a decision about what to include or not. What more, we've got a definition around materiality and a bit of discussion about what that may mean in the standards. There's a limit, given it's a matter of judgment ultimately, to what we can then add to that. And it's, I just want to clarify the mistake that I read earlier is that I didn't really go to the conceptual framework. What I did go to when I was a preparer was trying to find some guidance on materiality, and actually having to go to FEC guidance when actually I would have preferred to have some IFRS specific guidance or literature in order to have some discussions with my author and my recommendation.
Cora, please.
Yeah, I found that the contents of this are scattered around the many IFRS related documents, including constitutive framework, IS1, etc. And so, in that sense, I think this document looks like a kind of one-stop reference. And I could say that it is more structured, so that it is quite helpful for preparers, but at the same time that since it is referring to the real standard like IS1, so although this is not authoritative document, since you were suggesting to refer to IS1, in that regard that the preparers need to be constrained or that they need to follow IS1. Is my understanding right? This may not be an authority, but this suggests to refer IS1. So IS1 is a standard. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the preparers have to follow.
Yes.
That kind of mechanism.
Yeah.
So it's mandatory, if you like, to apply materiality when you prepare your IFRS financial statements. But when you think, and this is a document to help you think about how to apply that concept. But yes, the concept is.
Yeah. And so since this is more structured explanation of materiality scattered around the IFRS document, in that regard, this will help the preparers to know how they exercise judgment, etc. And at the same time, since they are referring to the standards, this document does not have authority or enforcement power, but the difference is that authority. So that I think that this kind of mechanism, if this kind of mechanism works, that this document would work. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
I read the document. I'll be able to very tired, which is not the best time to but I thought that the definition of materiality was excellent. And I think I don't understand why there's so much ambiguity around it. I mean, the definition is very clear. And this whole quantitative, qualitative thing, to me, it doesn't matter if it's principles basis, the definition clearly shows. But it's interesting about materiality because, a company that takes a massive impairment, that's material. Usually they'll put out a press release before they do the earnings to let the market know so it doesn't surprise them. And then of course it shows up in the financial statements when they report. So that's something that's, so that would impact, that's something that's quite obvious. Impact the securities that you'd be buying off the financial statements. But what about, material changes to the interpretations of the standards? Which if you run the cash flows and changes, then that may change the way you value the securities. So what I was thinking was, and maybe a really stupid idea, but we need an offering memorandum. There's a section called recent development that summarizes sort of material information since the striking of the offering memorandum or since the release. Could we not have a section in the report that sort of guides sort of an index of material changes to the accounting interpretation of accounting standards? Because really the problem is that I disclosed that my financials, I just never told anyone about it, never mentioned it, and maybe picked up on it, but to create more transparency, we've changed the way we account for leases, or we changed the way we recognize revenue. Nope, there's not going to be a press release about it the way there would be if you took a big impairment. And I might be the last guy, which is probably likely the case, would be the last guy to actually come across in the financial statements. So material information is being sort of disseminated in a not sort of uniform way, shall we say. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to, and then maybe by creating a section in the financial statements, to sort of index to material changes, the way we recognize revenue, see page, blah, blah, blah. We change the way we look, our logo is different, whatever. But I think, because that's, at least for me, that's the issue. Some of these material changes get obfuscated in loads of ink, and I guess it puts the onus on the preparers to basically pull the fig leaf off, sorry for the imagery, but pull the fig leaf off on something that they don't necessarily want to. But that's kind of the issue, here.
Yeah, is that it's a bit off topic because it's how
it's
related to how what you what you need to disclose, and this is really the definition of materiality. It's interesting. I mean,
I know we don't tend to not make radical departures like that, but it just seemed to concern me. I thought that actually definitely was fine.
I think it would make us our life easier if that information were.
You ask someone to disclose something to change materiality changes in the way you account for things, but I don't know. I mean, the comparison, the companies will say, yeah, put in the financial statements, you know, you should be, which is probably true, but when things are material, they're actually really material. They've got a press release to say, we took a $900 impairment, $900 million impairment, because we may have been bribing people in Uzbekistan. Vipocom, you know, but they won't say, you know, so then is it material? They change the way they account for leases compared to $900 million
assets. Maybe that's something to think about in the work we're doing on accounting policies.
Well, it is. We have been discussing accounting policies in part of the Principles of Disclosure project. And actually, disclosure accounting policies, I think, has quite a bit of interaction with materiality. And I think this idea of significant accounting policies is an aspect of that. But one of the things we did discuss was that what made something a significant accounting policy, and in particular, I think everybody was agreed that a change in accounting policy was one of those disclosures that you would need to make as part of that accounting policy disclosure. The other thing that we were talking about as part of that was, though, that it should be highlighted somewhere where there are changes and in particular options, because those are the key aspects of accounting policies that you don't want to lose in the depth of a discussion. You don't want to lose.
Exactly. And what I'm saying as an analyst, you would say there's certain things you go to right away, sort of quickly, and it might not, you know, it's a big change to those, but to have a section called, you know, material changes and, you know, material changes in accounting or material events, material, you know, whatever, then you go to that section and say, okay, change in, you know, revenue, change in logo, don't care about that, change in da-da-da-da-da, then, you know, just go straight to that to see if there's anything material.
Mm-hmm. We thought that would be also very important because there is a
we need to move on.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Sorry, I missed the very beginning of your prepared remarks. I apologize if you already mentioned response to this, but I did hear you say that you're not expecting a conflict between the statement and the local legal definitions. I guess there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of guidance in here if people are seeing a potential conflict between the local legal definitions and what's in the document. I'm just wondering, are you intending to do country-specific detailed commentary, I just think there's the potential for problems if we've got one definition in this document and another local statutory definition.
Well, there is a definition in IS1 and IS8, so the definition is already part of IFRS. So if the jurisdiction is applying IFRS, well then we'd hope that they already have the one in IS1 and IS8. And we did write to national standard setters and ask them whether they had, like, what kind of guidance they had. We didn't really get any responses that caused us a lot of concern. They were all in line with what was in IS1 and IS8. So I suppose we would hope that if there is someone who's reading this and they're saying, well, this wouldn't work in my jurisdiction, we'd hope they'd tell us that and it would come out as part of our outreach.
There is also a discussion of how we came to that conclusion, the basis of conclusions, and that if, for example, a local jurisdiction had a definition of materiality which meant that it was lower than the IFRS definition. There's nothing in IFRS that precludes you putting in something that might be immaterial from an IFRS perspective. If it's the reverse situation where you think IFRS is a lower threshold, so things that might be immaterial for the local jurisdiction but material for IFRS, it would be the reverse in the sense that they almost would have more information than they would had they used the local jurisdiction's definition of materiality. So that was from the logical perspective how we came to that conclusion that it shouldn't create a conflict, and then, as Ashling said, did quite a bit of research
joined the conference
across jurisdictions to see if in practice there was a conflict, because that conflict would exist at the moment, and we didn't hear that there was.
Okay. Welcome, Marietta.
Okay. Or Peter.
I'm part of the enforcement in Sweden. And the criticism that we receive is when we dig into the annual reports and look at the footnotes and look at the standard, we can see that, okay, the standard requires you to give us this information, you haven't said anything, why isn't it there? And they would reply, because it's not material. And then we say, yeah, you should have written that. Okay. I think in this conversation, this can help. This letter can help. From an enforcement point of view. Now, going to the company, if you have put together a table with certain values, the accounting system will give you the information. It's much more difficult to change the table that you put in a footnote than just stick to the footnote with this table, and if it becomes small numbers or big numbers, from a working workload point of view, it's better to stick to this table. Okay. So I think what it's all about, if I'm a preparer, is the original step into this. And normally we are talking about tables in the footnote that we're looking at. Changing it is much more difficult or time consuming. Now, looking at the same table from an analyst perspective, I can tell you I hate pensions, I hate financial instruments, I hate share-based payments. Within those three areas, I get a bunch of numbers included in the table. And that annoys me because I cannot really go through this table and probably I will not really understand what the idea with the table is. It's so much information, so much figures, and that annoys me. And that is the point in time when I, as an analyst, start talking about disclosure overload. Like, maybe there's a smoking gun in here, but I cannot see it. And the worst thing is, if someone else can, then I will look stupid. So I think from an analyst perspective, you don't want to have this overload because it scares you all the time. And I think pensions, financial instruments, and share-based payments, if you can reduce that part of the annual report, I think a lot of the annoyment from an analyst perspective regarding disclosure overload will disappear. I mean, looking at the table of property, plants, and equipment is no big deal, and so on. So I think having these like 2 or 4 pages long footnotes within these three areas, I think that is where the disclosure overload annoyment actually originates in an analyst perspective. Thank you.
Okay. I'm just trying to get back to the question number one.
What was the question?
The question is, will this practice statement be helpful for the investor to understand the materiality judgments that management have gone through? And what I'm grasping out of this discussion is that it's not really clear what parts of the practice statement are authoritative and what parts are not. And therefore, it may actually be a bit misleading because you may expect as an investor that all of it is authoritative, and obviously it is not. So I think it would be really beneficial and much more powerful if it becomes more authoritative to some extent. Also,
I don't know if I want to speak, actually. I was confused, but I thought the question was asking something different to what you're answering. Besides, just because you're answering the question, oh, should the statement be authoritative or not?
Yeah, and because it's not so authoritative, it
question,
doesn't...
That's what question are you asking? Question one.
It's not asking you, though.
It's asking...
So the answer, in my opinion, is probably not.
Oh, I agree with the answer. I definitely agree with the answer. I just wanted to say one thing in response to what Peter said with regard to disclosure overload and tables and the smoking gun. my view is that tables are fantastic, even if I don't use them, because I'm much more confident skimming them and turning the page to think that's not relevant. What worries me in terms of disclosure overload, which I don't think should be the focus, but if it is narrative, because that's where the smoking gun hides. The numbers are hidden in narrative if there's a smoking gun anywhere, and that's really concerning. If you have pages and pages of tables, I'm happy to skim them and turn, but I get worried about too much narrative.
Thank you, Oscar. Robert, please.
So, it's a very interesting comment about whether it's authoritative, and I seem to understand what we're being told is the standards already have sufficient standard level explanation, and that hasn't worked. So to the extent that you, I think what you've told us is we told them already in the standards what it was supposed to be. They're not getting it. Then the second piece is, do we do an interpretation? Or do we do a practice? And you've decided, we think the best way of telling these people what we've already told them is practice. So I'm not upset that it's not authoritative, because I think what you're saying is, read the standard, please, and since you haven't understood it, try this. Now, the next, and I will give you, my pet peeve on this one. Several statements have information in the MD&A, or the management commentary, and in the notes. And the I've seen word for word, they repeat it word for word, and it's mind-bogglingly tough to go through this stuff and read it word for word. The most offensive was, and I've seen this several times, where they talk about some fairly detailed talk about what they've done, and then on the application of standards, and then they say something to the effect of, we did the standard thing, or we haven't changed what we've done. So you've given me this whole paragraph, for some reason you thought you had to give me, and then you basically told me it's not material at the last word. That's this, and this goes back to commentary. I think the biggest problem is in comment, is in the words. I like tables. I think they're much easier, they're much more difficult to game. I think it's very easy to game and text. And I really get the feeling that a lot of these statements have a cover your liability text that is boilerplate, immaterial, counterproductive, contributes to a standard overload, and makes me cranky. I'll stop there. Makes me cranky because they're wasting my time.
Do you think it should be authoritative?
I took on face value what they were saying, which was, we told you already. So you can't write a standard that says, please read the standard. Besides, there are some technical issues about writing standards. They're complicated and long, take a look.
No.
I forgot to mention, actually, the reason I put the sign up, and that is, if I look through the document, in the beginning it's quite general, but on page 13, to be more precise, you get into a discussion like considering information about users' expectations, that is one point, and then you talk about management board requirement and so on. And both from an enforcer's point of view and I think a company perspective, I think having you underlining that you actually have to be active and seek what is material. It's late, it's English, so. I mean, you need to be active because, again, going back to the letter that we sent to the companies, I mean, if it is in the standard, and the companies don't read the standard, but the enforcer read it even more carefully and come up with a conclusion that they haven't put this table into the annual report, and the company comes back, say it's not material. Now you have told them, and maybe also the enforcer, what you need to do to figure out whether it is material or not. You need actually to go out and ask and try to interact with the users. And that, I think, is definitely a benefit. Maybe that is also included in some standard somewhere that I don't know about. But I think that is valuable. So on several Okay, several places in this document, you dig into that and say you need actually to be active and find out for yourself what is, in your case, materiality. Mm-hmm. And that is new to me.
Okay.
And good. A very good thing.
Thank you.
36 pages.
That's a challenge. I was 38. Yeah,
or even 38. That's a challenge.
Mitch?
On that 38, yeah, perhaps it's a bit prolonged to I would say that's a bit, and there, I found that there was some points I thought were a bit redundant, so maybe superfluous to the point. I agree, I mean, no companies won't do anything unless there's teeth, right? I mean, so it's like, that's nice, you know, but if I don't have to, you know, I don't think companies like to volunteer these kinds of things unless they're really forced to. Some sort of enforcement mechanism. And my last comment was just, it's maybe contrary to theme, but I actually don't mind a paragraph on some kind of legal action or some kind of event that ends in the sentence, and we don't deem this to be material, because as an analyst, sometimes you read these things, you're like, oh my God, this is material, you know, thank you for disclosing this, because it's gonna come out in the press, or some newspaper is gonna write about it or something, but I can see it's X percentage of our revenue, or maximum liability is X million, we can put that. So to me,
But in fairness, I think that example is, it's material that information, that liability isn't material. I think that's what...
Yeah, that's the material information, is that it's not material.
Yeah, but...
Okay, we have quite a number of questions. I'm not sure if you want, at this stage, want to contribute further. Do we want to move on with the next questions?
For the staff, what's most important for you?
Well, we have number one, which is, do you find this useful? Or do you have a better understanding of what the management have gone through when they made these statements? So do you have a preference between... Well, four you can cut out, because that's just any other comments. So we only have two others. I think there seems to be a bit of debate around the table as to whether this should be authoritative or not. I'm not sure I've got a sense of whether that's an agreement across the board that it should be or that it shouldn't be.
I'm not in favor of that. I think this is more to help the discussion and the development. So, just to give you another one.
I think it is insightful to read. It's actually a piece you can read about materiality, various aspects. The only thing that leaves me in the dark is how it, indeed, how authoritative is it? And so, yes, I like the document, but it's like, it could be a little bit more. You know, it could be...
Is your concern that you won't know whether or not somebody's actually applied the document or not because it's not authoritative? Is that your point?
And what of it is like wishful thinking? This is how it should be. It's like a best practice, and then I think there are elements in there which indeed, as it's underlined, which are authoritative because they are mentioned in the standards. Well, and what elements are like best practice? It's almost feels like a missed opportunity that you've done all the work, like. Detailing what it could be, what it should be, and then not saying, now apply it. It feels a bit like a missed opportunity. It doesn't mean it's not valuable, but it's we can have a discussion with management based on materiality given this piece. So they can say, well, it's not authoritative, and I can say, but we still expect it from you. So it's not that it's not useful, but it could be a little bit. It could be more. I think it's a bit of a missed opportunity.
I do think what we are aiming for is best practice, because actually we do not preclude the disclosure of immaterial information, and material information is required to be disclosed. So hopefully this helps a person decide that something is material, so it helps them meet the requirement. But also in terms of best practice, we would like to maybe minimize the amount of immaterial information as much as possible. So short of requiring that, I think it's helping people make those moves and making their disclosures more effective in that way, and this is what this is trying to do.
Well, then best practice is probably a better name than practice statement. It's a Peter, please.
Thank you. I see this as an educational statement, and being in education, you mentioned that you went to the SEC documentation when you were doing this. Mm-hmm. What were you getting out of that? And I'm just trying to go to this, the examples. I don't think it goes far enough if it's meant to be an educational statement. Because it says here, you should consider information about users' expectations. I think that's very obvious. It doesn't really help me. I mean, I would have to, it would always have to be educational in the sense, tell me about instances where this was missed, for example. Give me examples where, I mean, best practice can come out of like, these were missed opportunities in the past, because obviously this is prompted by demand for materiality, right? So, you know, the examples are there, and some of them are descriptive enough so that I can understand, but some of them are not. And so it would help, I think, if it actually is pushed a little bit further even than, well, generic statements about, like, users' expectations or something.
Just to respond to your question about what I was looking for. So, as a person preparing the financial statements for a large corporation, I was asked to look at our materiality and our policy on materiality and the thresholds as an overall concept, and we're having a discussion with the auditors at a later date. And so we want to make the decision is ours how we apply that. You know, the auditors are in process, but you know, we need to have that discussion as well. I'd go to the IFRS guidance, and that was actually quite limited. So you'd start searching around other places just to understand your thinking, how you would approach the issue, how you would approach that discussion with the auditors. It was also very helpful once you've developed that policy and the way of thinking, how you would then, you could use that when you were discussing it with more junior level members of staff, and particularly those who were having the discussions with the junior auditors who were talking when they were preparing those financial statements. So I was looking for something to guide my knowledge as a, and you know, I was with a big corporation having quite a sort of accounting policy background. I thought I was sort of at the level where you might have that education. I think there might be a lot of preparers out there who don't even have that background. So I think something quite accessible that pulls it together, that helps them think and as a basis and develop that. Useful, and that's maybe where it came from. The question
of
whether it achieves that.
No, it pushes in that direction. I just feel like it stops short of pushing it all the way.
Yeah, one of the questions we asked about examples, did they go far enough? The problem we also have on the other, there's only so far we can go.
Of course.
So it's a middle plank.
Awesome, please.
Just to repeat again, the question of trustability, I think it should be enforceable. And I appreciate it's not written as a standard, but to me it fits quite well into appendix to my favourite standard. It fits quite well into IS1 and appendix and certification guidance. That definition of materiality that is in here is taken straight from IS1, which is it's a fantastic definition. Yeah. Plain English, clear to understand.
Absolutely.
Very hard to apply because kind of material is a hard concept. But to elevate this to something that gets more notice, that enforcers can use, I think, would be the best use of it for them.
It's actually interesting, though, because I've heard some enforcers talk on the sort of authoritative aspect of it. And the ones I spoke to were concerned, if it were to be made authoritative, because obviously it's something we've talked about, would it actually be enforceable to say, for example, you have to restate your financial statements because you included immaterial information?
This practice doesn't say that you can't include material information at the moment. It just says try and think about it. It doesn't say you can't exclude it. You can't include it.
Yeah.
So,
but again, can you say you've done? You didn't question what people thought or didn't think about. I think it's because it's such a fuzzy thing. I think that, but obviously different. That's what we want feedback on. But I'm just trying to give you some colour for where we thought the challenges might be in practice.
I think in Denmark,
as
I said earlier, that this looks like the kind of one-stop difference, and the maritime robots suggest this. These descriptions are actually already in standards. So I'm not very sure that the this will change the behavior of preparers, you know, because simply because we have already all these. So, and the, I agree that the Peter's comment that the, you know, this may not be, this practice statement are not providing enough, you know, suggestions or guidance to how to conduct the materiality. That is my concern. But having said that, I think, yeah, it is still, you know, good thing to issue sometimes this practice statement, simply because this could provide an opportunity for preparers to review their own, you know, exercise of materiality. By doing so, that the this could be a kind of catalyst for them to review, or you know, if their financial statement contains the material, all material information, mm-hmm. or it includes immaterial information. So that I think that the, yeah, this might be too optimistic, but the, you know, I think that this could be a trigger of that kind of human exercise.
Thank you. Last comment before we move on to the next question, Robert.
We're actually talking, interesting enough, about two concerns. One concern is I think what this document is trying to address, which is the inclusion of immaterial information, because the preparers feel that they are required to by some source. And I think that's a very big problem, and it's an acute problem from a user point of view, because we get pushback on asking for material information, because they say, well, we can't answer everything. So the game here has almost been, we'll throw a whole bunch of stuff that really isn't material, show that the financial statements are now running 300 pages, and now we can justify not adding really good stuff. And so I'm very keen to get this to work, because I'm hoping you're going to get it down to 150 statements, which means there's another 50 pages of real stuff. And now that's the secondary concern that I think all users have, is we're afraid also of some really material stuff slipping under the radar, either because they've hidden it in a whole bunch of immaterial stuff, or because they use this narrow application of materiality based upon a number. And I heard that, you know, the materiality threshold is the accountant's way, it's the number is $5 million, and if it's not, we don't think in terms of a threshold. We think about, is it going to change the value? And it could be as simple, you know, fraud, a tiny fraud, means there are no internal controls, means now we're nervous. And so the concept of materiality used by the accounting profession as threshold is not ours. And I'll stop there.
And actually, that doesn't make it really transparent. That there's a big difference between what you described in the materiality practice statement and what we see auditors currently describe on materiality, because the start word for the auditor is a number.
But the definitions, you're exactly right, the definition should include exactly that kind of behavior, that which would impact an investor's view of value of security, whether it's five or whether it's, you know.
So in that way it is helpful.
But it's in the definition already, it's a great definition.
Yeah. Mm.
Auditors, there's a reason why they use a threshold, and it's actually a good starting point in a lot of cases. I mean, not everything needs to have this great qualitative judgment around it. Sometimes the quantitative amount can be sufficient to make that, but it's not always sufficient. But I think what we tried to get out of here is this isn't the auditing definition, and it's a different purpose than the auditing, and trying to separate that.
But I'm not, that's actually what, that's where the support comes through. Nowhere in the standard should it be based on a threshold. Every auditor will tell you, we don't use a threshold. And every single one of them, if you dig deep enough, you'll find out there is a threshold.
It's disclosed, no?
Now I can go back to a particular auditor and tell them they're lying, because they told me that they didn't want to disclose what their threshold was.
They don't use a threshold alone, but they do.
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap this up. What
that's an expression you would like to look forward to.
Do you think any additional content should be included in the practice statement? We might have covered that a little bit. If there's anything else, or any other comments?
I think we made all our comments there. Any other comments?
Is that helpful or is it vague enough that it's...
Did you get material in from us?
But is it going to change our decision?
I can tell you this, that if we don't address this issue at all, the enforcers will, because this is a big issue between the enforcer and the company. And I know quite sure that in Denmark, they really put up the threshold. They said that if the amount is equal to, I think it was 1% of the kind of headline amount, like if you have property, plant, and equipment, 1,000, if the amount that you are aiming at is more than 1% of that 1,000, you need to specify it.
That's quite a low.
Yeah, but it's the world that an enforcer lives in. It's a constant struggle around this. We don't really see that. We just skip the information that are too big or too many or we don't like. But between the enforcer and the company, this is something that is a big issue. Also in this ESMA organization where they all meet.
That's the wrong tool. A dollar amount is the wrong tool.
Yeah, well, that's right.
From
I agree.
A user point of view.
But if we don't address the topic, this issue, I think that is where we are heading.
I think that's the beauty of the principles based. Maybe what we need is the guidance support of a document like that to help set the boundaries of what, okay, if you don't use a number and it's purely principle based as opposed to quantitative, you know, maybe some guidance, I guess, around that, which is perhaps what you're trying to achieve. But at the end of the day, if it's going to affect the change evaluations of securities, then it's material. And that requires interpretation, but you can always err on the side of being conservative in that, and you should, one should.
And that's actually the strength of this document, being discursive rather than authoritative. I think that it helps people think about it as from a principles basis rather than from a rules basis.
Yes.
And therefore, they're obliged to think about it intelligently, judgmentally, rather than, oh God, let's find that one number that's the rule that gives us the answer,
yeah.
Which is not the answer that we all need.
So maybe there's nothing wrong with the definition, it's just, yeah.
I don't know many companies, at least they don't ask me, that discuss with others than people on the accounting department what is actually material, what should be included. I have never come across companies that actually try to gather some investors together and say, well, we want to change this, so what do you think about that? So to me, having this included in this document, it really underlines that you need to do that kind of footwork.
There's a risk if companies go out and do that because it might imply that they're selectively disclosing something they're considering changing that has a material impact. So they can't, right now I think the company can't be precluded from doing that on the selective disclosure basis.
Yeah, you know, I think all of us, this group, we would be able to relatively easily go through the audited financial or the draft audit financial statements and say material, not material, and we would get it 99.9% right every single time. The problem is the auditors and the accountants don't think the same way. They're not trained to think that way, and I don't think they're trained that way. The other thing, the reality you also face in the accounting profession. Is it's the junior people who do all the work, and the partner, the senior people are the ones that.
I don't fully understand how the accounts are made prepared, but if it's done internally, then the CFO or someone in Treasury would have the ability to interpret whether the change that's being implemented would be material or not. And so, but if you're going to make an accounting change, the CFO or the Treasurer or someone is going to have a view on that because it's not going to happen.
But it's you hit it exactly. The treasurer and the guys that sit in the business evaluation, there's some business evaluation guys. They're also women too. They'll sit close to the treasurer. They'll sit close to the treasurer who has a view on the capital markets. probably knows it, who spends all of his time dealing with sort of financial market materiality. He's got it. The guy across the hallway, the woman across the hallway who is a controller, isn't trained that way. They'll have different titles. There are very different cultures in those two organizations.
No.
They are different.
No, I think if I look at the parts that I mentioned previously, like pensions, financial instruments, share-based payments, and so on, you have experts in those areas. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that maybe understand all the lines and columns included in that footnote. I can tell you for sure that if I look at the IAS 39 footnote, I cannot tell you what is material and immaterial, because I really don't see the smoking gun.
But
and definitely
you,
not with pensions either.
But there is, there is a CFO who sits on the pension committee, or the treasurer, and very often, by the way, it's treasurers who sit on the pension committee, not the controller. They'll tell you exactly which lines are material on that thing.
No.
They know.
Well,
to remove it from the financial statements, or if you're implementing a new change to put something new in, you tend to have buy-in at that very high level. But
there's going to be that much of a disconnect.
Yeah, and so that when you are preparing the financial statements and you are at a lower level and you've got your certain group that you have to do, you think, oh, it might be a good idea to take this out. I don't think it's... One, you've got to have the overview, and then two, you've got to go through quite a bit of a process to have that discussion at the lower auditor level, and then maybe at the sort of higher level, maybe with your lawyers, depending on your regulatory. So there is a process to be had, and I think we hope that this sort of helps that.
I need to make something clear in my assumption here. I think it's the reason we've got a lot of immaterial information in financial statements is not because the company wants to put it in, but because they've just given up fighting with the auditors. That's where this is coming from. So that's why my comment about the junior people are, you know, they're bombarding the accounting staff with it. The controller is not in a position to fight back. The treasurer may be able to do it because they've got markets, but he may also just say, oh, to hell with this.
Yeah.
So it really is, it's pick your battles,
Does this
our
document
office.
Help them? Does this document help them to fight back?
The moment it tells the audit people that it shouldn't be a threshold, why it picked up on so aggressively on the threshold, and it should be, you know, does it impact the investment, that the analyst, it's forcing them out of their comfort zone. It forces that junior first year audit to say, wait a minute, I can't use a threshold because I don't get a threshold. I think the problem is the auditors and their liability insurance.
I like very much the definition of materiality because I think it's very relevant for us. But I agree with Robert in a way. Then they have to guess what we think, and as he pointed, they are not from the same planet. I mean, even without challenging the components, I mean, they have to guess what we would like to have. So it's applying it in a way would be. I think for auditors, perhaps terribly difficult.
Maybe not.
I believe for tough. I mean, taking the point of view of Martians, people. From another planet, in a way.
We have 2 minutes left. I have one question. I mean, this document probably was presented to auditors as well. Were they very surprised? Like, oh my God, is this material as well? Or what was the reaction of the auditor community on this? Have you got any...
We consulted with the international...
auditing board, the IWSB. I was trying to work out what the actual...
Audit and Assurance Standards
Board. as we were developing this document, because we've said that the materiality for an audit and the materiality we work in are slightly different purposes, but they are interrelated. Well, so they need to work. So they were, I'm going to say supportive. They definitely didn't respond as if there was a conflict between what we were writing and what they had in their audience. Weren't too surprised, and in terms of review, they had sort of constructive rather than conflicting comments. It'd be interesting to see.
What we only published it last week, so let's see what the comments
Well, shall we wrap it up with this? Any other comments anyone wants to make on this document? Well, thank you.